If all goes according to plan, starting 1 week from today, 100 Boston police officers will be wearing body cameras on duty, partly in response to several shootings by police officers of young black men elsewhere in the country. When the plan was first floated, no officers volunteered to wear the devices in Boston, so police officers were chosen to take part. Training on the cameras began yesterday. And to talk about how the plan is going so far, we're joined this morning by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor, good morning, and thanks for speaking to Morning Edition.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with an update. The 100 police officers are in training right now on how to use the equipment. How's it going, and what are they doing?
So far, it started yesterday, and really going through the legal terms of what's required of officers, how these cameras work. Making sure that the officers understand them. And over the course of the next few days, we're going to be training them, and we're going to be training the superiors, and we'll have them out in the street sometime next week.
It was difficult for the city to get the 100 candidates, the 100 officers for the program. No one volunteered. The participants were then selected, which is kind of like ordered to be volunteers. Have you won them over yet? Are they now willing participants?
Yeah, I had a chance yesterday to talk to many of the officers there. Many of them were very open to the idea. Again, it's a change in the way that police do their work. It's another piece of technology that they have to be careful of, something else they have to make sure that when they report, that they work accurately on their reports. So I think at the end of the day, we'll be able to see through this pilot the comfort of the police officers. Obviously, our police department, we have very intelligent officers and very capable officers. So they're going to catch on to the use of this equipment and how they work pretty quickly.
The police department says 55 of the participants are white, 29 are black, 13 are Latino, 3 are Asian, and there's been some criticism of that, as you know. The NAACP has questioned why what it calls a disproportionately high number of black officers are wearing the cameras in this pilot program.
That's simply not true. I mean, that's just not true. I mean, I'm not sure exactly. I don't have the exact numbers of the breakdown of the Boston Police Department. But, you know, I think that a lot of people are giving their opinion on what a body camera does it's supposed to do. And I can tell you, I don't think anyone fully understands the program, and we're going to learn this as we move forward. I think that there's always going to be criticism on a lot of different things that we do. And I think I would appreciate if we could just let's see how the pilot works before we start to criticize this. This is an independent decision how we pick these officers. So, I mean, I don't know if we can ever make everybody happy all the time, but certainly we're moving forward here. Myself and the commissioner mentioned that about a year ago that we would have a pilot program, and we have a pilot program, so we're moving forward.
Do you know why no officers from the largely Latino East Boston neighborhood were
because
not
East
selected
Boston,
for the pilot?
East Boston was not one of the areas selected. But, however, the officers that were selected, I think one of the criticisms was that the interaction with the Latino community. We have the Latino community throughout the entire city of Boston, and we're going to continue to work with everybody to make sure that we see how this works.
How is the body camera pilot program going to be measured? What metrics will assess its success or failure?
We're going to look at metrics. It's also going to be human interaction, and we're going to be talking to people from the public and also the police officers.
So it's a six-month-long pilot program. Do you anticipate that, assuming it's successful, that there'll be a quick or a slow rollout to all other Boston police officers?
Well, we have to look at how the pilot works, and also we have to look at as far as the payment of these. This a full implementation of this body camera program is going to be roughly between $6 and $8 million for the entire department if we were to do something like that. So again, there's a lot of questions. I'm not going to get way ahead of myself right now. I want to focus on the pilot, see how the pilot works, and then take the steps after that.
And what guidelines are in place for making body camera video public, Mayor, if there's some sort of incident that might necessitate that?
At some point, we'll be able to give that information. That's something that I know that the legal team is working on and seeing how we move forward with that. But any time that we've had an incident in the city that involves a police-involved shooting, within a very short period of time, if there's video, we get it out on the street.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks a lot for speaking to Morning Edition about this pilot program where officers are wearing police body cameras.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Vermont Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wants his new political organization called Our Revolution to support progressive candidates across the country. It will also take sides in ballot questions in several states. Sanders supporters had their first chance to hear from their candidate since the Democratic National Convention. They held house parties in every state to watch a live stream address from Sanders. It included 17 people who gathered at a home in Jamaica Plain in Boston. WBUR's Fred Tice reports.
The small band of supporters came from Jamaica Plain, Roslindale, and West Roxbury. Most said they would vote for Hillary Clinton in November. All are still recovering from the disappointment of Sanders' defeat in the primaries. Several had questions about the financing of the new organization. As a super PAC, it would be able to draw large sums from anonymous donors, something Sanders had criticized during his campaign. But they were excited to hear where Sanders wants to take his movement next. Mary Brady, one of the hosts, said she was drawn to the Sanders campaign not so much by a desire to see him become president as by an energy she had not seen since her youth in the 60s and 70s.
It brought together people with whom I feel comfortable. Once again, because it's been a while. And what I want to have happen is we've got our group together. Now let's do something. I respect Bernie leading us to look locally and perhaps to find some people who want to run and support them in a real concrete way so that we begin to have progressive voices at all levels of government again.
Brady plans to campaign against the Massachusetts ballot initiative to expand charter schools and support Democrat Maggie Hassan's bid to take Republican Kelly Ayotte's U.S. Senate seat in New Hampshire.
Well, I do think it is important to say a few words about what we accomplished together.
Sanders spent most of the hour talking about the accomplishments of his presidential campaign, but he did name some of the candidates and ballot initiatives his group would support. He did not mention any causes or candidates in Massachusetts. And he announced that as a sitting U.S. senator, by law, he could not be directly involved in the work of the group. The presentation earned mixed reviews from his fans on Moss Hill. Some got exactly what they were looking for. Others were more critical.
He went on for a long time. I thought the whole presentation was not very good.
Several people were disappointed that Sanders was short on specifics and did not really explain how they could be engaged. Still, the campaign said tens of thousands of people watched. In his campaign, Sanders drew young voters. But in the room, almost everyone had gray hair. Still, Mary Brady was not worried that no young people showed up at her house.
We have these discussions with our kids, who are our daughter's 29, in that this is not their thing. They wouldn't come to this kind of a thing.
The campaign says 200,000 people followed Sanders on Facebook Live. That's where the young people were, quipped one woman. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
When you listen to Anna Deavere Smith, you don't just hear Anna Deavere Smith. The playwright and actor channels the voices of dozens of people in her unique works for the stage. She's made plays about everything from race riots to healthcare, featuring one actor on stage, Smith, in all the roles. Lately, she's talked with hundreds of people about what's called the school-to-prison pipeline, the path that can take a kid from kindergarten suspension through juvenile hall to prison. And now she's turned their voices into her latest play, titled Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education. It's at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, and WBUR's Louise Kennedy reports.
Anna Deavere Smith's mother was a teacher in Baltimore, so she's seen how schools have changed.
It's very difficult now for a single person to make a difference, and that's what my mother and all her friends did. She always had these big boys at our house. She's teaching them to read, and all I'd hear over here was always some kid that they were changing. And I think it's a really hard thing to do now.
She says the reasons are complex and the results are stark. More young men, especially young men of color, out of school and in prison.
It's not even fair to call it the school-to-prison pipeline because we seem to be blaming teachers and schools for something that's a pretty complex social problem.
So Smith talked to all kinds of people, teachers, students, cops, prisoners, 250 of them so far. Then she selected some of their stories verbatim and built a play out of them, Notes from the Field. On stage, Smith plays all the characters. Her voice, her stance, and her gestures shift in a flash to create a shy teenager or a renowned author or an inmate or a judge. Her work goes beyond mere impersonation to fill the stage with a whole world of people. Here, she's a young man who's had run-ins with the police.
If they know you from being bad, not even being bad, being in the area, hanging with somebody that they know is bad, they're going to rash you.
Now, she's the writer James Baldwin.
What should we do about the children? We are responsible for the future of this world.
Smith places the voices in counterpoint to one another. Their stories collide and connect to create a kind of choral response. Like here, at the end of a scene with Georgia Congressman John Lewis. Smith, as Lewis, recalls a former Klansman who visited him to ask his forgiveness.
I seen that guy 4 times since then. He called me brother. I call him brother.
Call and response. One voice speaks, another answers. Together, they build the story. And this time, there's that other voice on stage, the jazz bass. Musician Marcus Shelby says it's a collaboration of the spirit.
Much like in the black church, where you just have this sort of back and forth between the minister and the people in the pulpit or in the choir, we kind of try to relive that or recreate that.
Sometimes Shelby plays in response to something Smith says. Sometimes he just listens.
It's self-expression, all right? It's inflection, it's call and response, it's improvisational, and it's personal. And it's also used within a collective. And that's how musicians use the blues.
Shelby says that approach goes beyond music.
Because it's your personal expression in this sort of democratic system of where everybody's voice is accepted, and not only accepted, but necessary for it to reach its potential.
And that's what Smith believes about the unusual second act of Notes from the Field. In Act One, she does her typical magical impersonations. But Act Two? In Act Two, she breaks the audience into groups of about 20 and sends them off to talk about what they've just seen. They're led by local volunteers.
It's a chance to engage the audience in a broader civic discussion, to blur the lines between what goes on in the stage and what goes on in our civic life.
Harvard professor Michael Sandel is a discussion leader.
Our challenge will be to make the audience not just spectators, but participants.
An earlier production of the play asked audience members to commit to one specific thing they'd do. Marcus Shelby was there, and he was inspired to say he'd take music into prisons.
I was like, well, now I gotta go. I made a commitment.
And he's kept it.
So for the past 3 years, I've been going into San Quentin, Folsom Prison. Every month I go to juvenile hall.
Anna Deavere Smith knows that's not for everyone, but she hopes people will visit a classroom or read to a child, or work together to improve their school.
And these people, I think, have a great potential when we have left to network and to really do the work when we're gone. The circus has left the town.
It's a way to make the play larger than its 2 or so hours in the theater.
There's just so much I can really do, but I do think one thing we can do in the arts is to apply ourselves to think about how can we increase and celebrate the idea of empathy and compassion, because it ain't going to happen in business. It's very hard to implement it in schools now. And so somebody's got to do it.
Somebody like Anna Deavere Smith, or Marcus Shelby, or the teachers, students, cops, and ordinary citizens that Smith hopes will take action in response to her call. For 90.9 WBUR and Edify, I'm Louise Kennedy.
It's a scene out of America's Industrial Revolution past. In Lowell, dozens of looms weave together lines of white thread at the Boot Cotton Mill. The mill complex is part of the Lowell National Historical Park and part of the National Park Service. Today marks the centennial of the creation of the Park Service, which also manages places such as Yosemite National Park, the Grand Canyon, and Mount Rushmore. This park was created in Lowell in 1978, one of the nation's first urban parks. Lowell Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas helps oversee the Park Service as a member of the House Subcommittee for Federal Lands. We met her outside the Boot Cotton Mills to talk about the Park Service on its birthday and ask how an urban park fits into the popular view of national parks as places of natural beauty.
Well, if you look back at the act that actually created the National Park Service, it always recognized that it would be protecting historical sites, cultural sites, as well as the extraordinary physical sites that we think so much of as being in the national park system. This is the first planned industrial city in the country. This place spawned the Industrial Revolution, changed the way in which we make things.
All right, so pretend for a moment that you've never been here before, but you've decided you're going to visit the National Park in Lowell. What do you think, for a first-time visitor, would blow them away? You know, when you see the mountains in the west for the first time, you're blown away. What would blow people away about visiting this park in Lowell for the first time, do you think?
People are always taken aback by the architectural treasures of the Industrial Revolution. These buildings are simply magnificently beautiful. But it's also a history of the peoples who made this possible.
From the perspective of your work in Congress, looking ahead, what are the challenges, in your view, facing the National Park Service in the immediate years ahead?
Well, we have had over 300 million visitors in this year alone, but you would not know that in the kind of funding. So the biggest challenge we have is funding. Over the years, we've accumulated a very significant backlog of in maintenance, about $12 billion. Half of that really are the roads that make it possible for people to travel through, especially the larger sites out west. There is legislation out there that recognizes the centennial and the importance of our national parks, but funding does not follow suit. And that's true in many other areas as well, where we know without funding, all the good ideas in the world really are very challenged going forward.
What sort of places do you think need preserving in the future that aren't preserved now?
Much depends on members of Congress working with their constituents to identify new sites, whether it's a historic site, whether it's a cultural site, whether it's a site of great beauty, for them to bring those ideas forward. But what, in the end, we want it to represent is a diversity of peoples, the diversity of talents, the diversity of efforts that have made this country the great place that it is.
And what do you think the role of the Park Service will be or should be over the next 100 years?
It's going to have to be adaptive. One of the things we've had to focus on is, as much as you want people to go into a park and sort of appreciate the natural beauty and be kind of cut off from civilization, the reality is that new visitors today, our younger generation, wants to be internet connected. So we have to find ways in our park settings to do that. It's probably only a matter before they're playing Pokemon in the national parks. It's a matter of time, if not already.
And how do you hope that people observe the 100th anniversary?
By going to their parks. If you could come to the Lowell National Historical Park and appreciate the Industrial Revolution, but I would say go down the road and go to the Minuteman National Park, because the remarkable thing about that is the simplicity of the place in which our revolution began.
Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, thanks a lot for meeting us here in Lowell at the park.
Well, thank you for making a trip out here and seeing this beautiful site.
We spoke with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas in Lowell for the anniversary of the National Park Service, founded 100 years ago on this day in 1916. And this is one of the biggest hits of that year. It's Sunshine of Your Smile, sung by John McCormick. Love lightning.